Hi, this is Ashley Gallagher from Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Pharmacy Tech Talk as part of Pharmacy Focus. The Pharmacy Tech Talk podcast is intended to focus on the growing role and responsibilities for pharmacy technicians, the tools and trainings they need, and challenges they face. In this month's episode, I will be talking with Amy Summers, consultant at Restore Health Consulting, on the proposed changes to the USP Chapter 795 and 797.
USP Chapter 795, it's titled Pharmaceutical Compounding Non-Sterile Preparations. So that kind of gives you a clue that we're talking about the minimum standards to follow when compounding a non-sterile preparation. And USP 797, which is titled Pharmaceutical Compounding Sterile Preparations, it talks about the minimum standards to follow when you're trying to compound a sterile preparation. So the chapters, they're broken down into several sections. They talk about things like personnel training and competency, hand hygiene, garbing requirements, facilities, engineering controls, how to certify them, all those kind of specifications. The sterile chapter talks a little bit about microbiological air and surface monitoring. There's cleaning, disinfecting, all these other things, material transfer. There's lots of different sections to be talked about in each. And they also even talk about things like quality assurance, SOPs, beyond use dating, that's a big ticket item right now, and even things beyond the SOPs, such as, you know, like handling and storage and packing and all these other sections within the chapters. So they're kind of extensive and there's a lot to remember. But that's just the general overview of what they are.
The differences between sterile and non-sterile preparation are pretty important, which is why it is important to know what kind of compound you're dealing with.
Let's start with the non-sterile preparation. It doesn't have to be sterile. So there is some level of microbes that could be present, which is called bioburden. That's another term for it. But anyhow, this they don't need to be sterile because it's not being introduced into the body that could cause sepsis or some kind of, you know, major injury in a short period of time. So we're talking things like a topical cream or a topical ointment or an oral suspension or solution. It's not being delivered directly into the bloodstream. And if you can imagine, you know, sterile preparations, there, let's say we're gonna inject into, you know, the muscle or subcutaneous areas or intrathecal injection or intravenous infusions, even ophthalmics that are going to the eye, things that can even be implanted into your body, there's a zero tolerance for having any bioburden or just microbial contamination present in those products. And so a few years ago, I'm not sure if you're privy to this, but it was like 2012, there was a huge, huge issue that happened to our industry with the New England Compounding Center. And they had basically, their compounds were contaminated and they were sterile compounds, and it caused major serious injuries and death in several people. So it was actually the tipping point of our compounding industry, and it gave birth to something called the 503B outsourcing facility designation. And since then, we've actually seen a lot of the regulations tighten up from then. So I guess coming back to your other part of your question about why is it important in the hospital setting, I think it's for the reasons that I just mentioned, right? So it's talking about how, you know, if you want to make something sterile, there's no wiggle room here. It has to be completely free of microbial contamination.
The USP is important for patients, pharmacy technicians, and pharmacists. The USP Chapter 795 and 797 are used to reduce the risk of patient harm.
Let me back up for you a little bit and kind of explain to you what USP is. So USP is a, they're a nonprofit and they're a scientific entity. They're composed of all sorts of different types of people, like physicians, pharmacists, scientists, and they come together, and their mission is to improve, you know, health and safety within medicines and foods. Their scope is to develop and publish standards for the identity, strength, quality, and purity of drug substances, finished drug products, excipients, even things in the food industry and dietary supplements. So their goal is to basically, with respect to compounding, to reduce the risk of patient harm from contamination and infection, incorrect dosing, compounded products. So these chapters, they provide the minimum requirements of compounded preparations. And compounders must follow these standards to minimize harm, including death, to humans and even animal patients. So that's really the importance of 795 and 797 as it relates to patients. But it's also important to understand that from USP, they don't directly enforce these standards because they don't have the regulatory authority. They leave that up to, let's say, the state and federal entities. So like the Department of Justice, the Food and Drug Administration, state boards of pharmacy, those entities are the ones that are going to enforce. But USP is sort of like this, you know, this nonprofit entity of like, here's the minimum that we want you to meet to keep people safe. And, but basically going back to the technicians and the pharmacists, it behooves these folks to know and understand these standards to follow. So it can keep your operations, consistent with the minimum standards of practice. And it basically protects, you know, patients, number one, but also, you know, your license. You want to do good. You don't want to harm. So I would say it's a little bit of a tangent, but as a consultant and an expert witness to this industry, I would say if I were to advise licensees, this is just the bare minimum. And we're finding that boards of pharmacy and the FDA audits of compounding facilities, they expect a little bit more than, you know, just following a checklist that USP provides. You need to prove that your compounds are safe. So when you get these audits, definitely meet the standards, but they are minimum standards. So you're going to also need to go above and beyond that a little bit, at least to basically explain why you do what you do with science. So I hope I answered your question, and I think I was getting on a tangent there, but it is a good sort of minimum standard to follow.
There are a few new proposed changes to the USP chapter 795.
Yes, 795. There's several minor changes. I guess I won't get into all of them. I'll let the folks here, go and listen to the actual talk that we're going to give. But so there's lots of little minor changes. But the major ones that I'd like to tell you about today, they're focused on something called beyond use dating limits. And this is happening in the absence of a USP monograph to go off of, or in the absence of a stability study for that specific product that you've made. And there's also something, this new concept that USP introduced called water activity. So water activity, it's like, what is that? Is it just how much water is in it? But basically the term water activity is supposed to help compounders understand, is your compound aqueous or is it non-aqueous? Because you need to know that to be able to then assign the correct beyond use date. So this term water activity is going to help us do that. And so they defined it in the chapter that aqueous compounds, they're going to have a water activity of greater than or equal to this value 0.6, that this compound has a lot of free water or available water. And anything that has a lot of available or free water, they may participate in hydrolytic reactions and support microbial growth. So conceptually, you're thinking the more water activity it has, it's going to last shorter. It could be prone to contamination. And so the non-aqueous types of compounds, they're the ones that have a water activity that's less than 0.6. And they can still be, you know, oral liquids. They don't have to be like solids, but essentially, it's the same kind of concept, that it just has less water activity. So the beyond use dates for those kinds would be longer. So speaking about beyond use dates, you know, we can figure out what the beyond use date limit is of a compound. So for aqueous dosage forms, the BUD limits are given a shorter time than non-aqueous, because basically the aqueous ones are more reactive and then they support microbial growth. So I hope I'm driving that message home to you. I think I've said it a couple times now. But USP also is subcategorized the aqueous compounds into preserved and non-preserved. So imagine if you have a preservative, that gets you a little bit longer time to use it versus the non-preserved, it's a much shorter time still. So they basically, if you go to this table, it's a very important table to look at, and it sort of breaks down all of this. But, you know, essentially non-aqueous liquids, they also have a BUD that's longer than any aqueous liquid. And if you're a non-aqueous non-liquid, so like the other dosage forms, they can get something assigned up to 180 days. So yeah, I think those are something to consider with the major changes. And I think some of these things give us more flexibility as compounders, you know, and some it's just a matter of, as a technician, you know, how's this going to affect you? I don't think that the 795 changes regarding water activity or even beyond use dating limits affect technicians too much, other than it may end up falling on them to make sure that their beyond use dates are consistent with the chapter. So maybe that could mean if they were responsible for, I don't know, if they're typing the prescription or they're printing out that master formula to be a compounding record, then they got to make sure that that beyond use date is correct. And if it's not, maybe they need to go and help the pharmacist update those master formulas to reflect the new chapter. I would also say there's, and we didn't go into this too much, but there's a lot of other little minor changes that actually could affect technicians. So I think USP 795, it talks about how weighing powders, even if they're non-hazardous, they need to be done so in like a contaminated ventilation enclosure. And so it's just like a hood, if you will, and it just contains those powders. So that might be something new for technicians, maybe not, but also the cleaning might get a little bit more systematic and defined, and they might need to change their policies and procedures and help those pharmacists to update those things. So yeah, I would say that just generally speaking, if this proposal goes through and gets approved, those are the kind of changes that technicians could expect and maybe have to help out with.
And there are also new proposed changes to USP Chapter 797.
I think the major change in USP 797 is that they introduced this new category called Category 3 of compounding. And essentially these compounds are the ones that, let's say a facility wants to have a longer beyond use date than what the USP limit allows. They can do this, but they're going to have to jump through a lot more hoops. Things like testing sterility of their sterile compound that has this longer beyond use date, testing endotoxins if applicable, perform more personnel qualifications more frequently, for example, every 3 months. They need to use sterile garb. They can't have any skin showing. They need to conduct stability studies through stability indicating methods. There's also something to remember that there's a cap of 180-day BUD put on this Category 3 compound. And so essentially they can't even go beyond 180-day. They do all this work, but then they can't go beyond that. So yeah, I think there are a lot of changes with regard to that aspect. But on the other hand, I think it's kind of interesting that administration is not part of the scope any longer. So it's kind of like a little bit of a loophole, I guess, for some folks out there. So basically, if administration is not considered compounding, there's a couple things that a entity might want to consider. So let's say you want to go off of the like a product that's commercially prepared, and there's a manufacturer label, and it says that you can prepare this for administration in this certain way, this single dose for this single patient. And if this pharmacy follows that, it's not considered compounding. There's a few other little hoops to jump through. Like, for example, the product has to be prepared as that single dose for that individual patient. You must go off that improved labeling so that it really specifies the diluent to use, the strength that's going to end up with, the container closure system you're going to use, and how long you can store it for. But it's interesting because if you're going to do this, then you're not having to follow USP. So that might be something that could affect folks as well. So how it affects technicians, and if your facility is going to be doing these Category 3 compounds, then you're going to have a lot more stuff to do. Like all that garb you're going to be wearing, it's got to be sterile. You're going to be doing your personnel qualifications every 3 months, and you're going to be cleaning so much more often. You're going to be environmental monitoring so much more often. So that is going to look like a lot of work. And I would say, on the other hand, the other side of the spectrum, for those that might just be doing a single dose for a single patient at the time, maybe that hospital will sort of take those kinds of compounding out of the program and do a lot more bedside administration rather than centralized compounding. I can't speak for these entities, but that just seems like there was, you know, two major changes there.
We are taking a short break for tech tips. Sometimes medication needs to be returned to stock. All sensitive information must be crossed out on the bottles before it can be returned back to the shelf. For some medication, like inhalers or topical creams, the label must be completely taken off the box. Sticking the label to the back of your hand before putting it on the box will make the label easier to remove if returning the medication back to stock is necessary. Another way would be to fold the corner of the label before sticking it to the box. This would make it easier to peel off if necessary. If you have any of your own tips to share, email the link in the description of this episode. Remember, these tips are only suggestions. Always make sure to check with your pharmacy supervisor or a pharmacist for proper protocol, as every pharmacy and its workflow are different. Now back to the show. What could these changes mean for hospitals as a whole?
Yeah, I think I'm sort of hinting there in the last answer was, you know, basically, especially for the sterile compounds, that are you going to do category three? Do you need to do category three? Because if you do, do you want to maybe consider opening your own 503B if you're like a large, you know, health system that has to serve all of these sites, and you want to have an extended beyond use dating for, you know, several different products? Maybe that's something to consider, because USP is going to make you do all these other hoops anyway. So maybe it would be something for the large health systems to look into. But on the other hand, maybe they'll downsize their compounding department, and maybe they'll opt for more of an administration at bedside. And so, you know, I'm not really sure, but you know, the other details, you know, hospitals are going to have to align their SOPs and master formulas with the changes. So that's already, you're going to have to make sure that you've got the human resources to close those gaps and align with the updates. But you know, on the other hand, just remember that's not finalized yet. Things can still be amended and changed. So I would, if I were them, I would just be cognizant of that.
Training for sterile and non-sterile compounding is important in order to reduce the risk of patient harm. The proposed changes would also affect some training methods.
Sure. You know, as a consultant, I have seen some pretty skimpy methods of training. But basically, I just want to mention that the best way to train personnel is by having the personnel first read about the topic, shadow a subject matter expert, try it under their supervision, repeat the trial so they get good at it and they're starting to feel comfortable, but they still have that person next to them as, you know, the sort of a security. And then at the end, when they're feeling really good and they don't have any more questions and they're not making any more mistakes, then they can take that written test and that physical practical competency exam and show how good they are at this new thing that they've learned. So that's sort of like the best way to train. But as for the proposed changes and how they're going to relate to 795, knowledge and competency, they must be demonstrated at least every 12 months. They need to go over hand hygiene, garbing, cleaning and sanitizing, handling and transporting components and the compounds themselves, measuring and mixing, the proper use of equipment and devices, and even the documentation on how to document your compounding process. And for 797, you know, the written and electronic testing, they must be completed at least every 12 months. And in the similar kinds of things, the hand hygiene, the garbing, the cleaning, calculations, aseptic technique, how to use the equipment properly, how to document things, even airflow and how that all works, how to use your own PEC or the primary engineering control, which is also called the hood that you're working in, the personnel and material flow, how you get things into that compounding area, you know, the competencies like the media fill, the glove fingertip testing, all that stuff, that's basically performed every 6 months if you're doing your basic category one and category two, and every 3 months if you're going to do category three. So it is a bit more intense in that current chapter. And that last reminder that I want to point out is that personnel are absolutely not allowed to compound or do any of that stuff until they are deemed trained and competent. So essentially, that initial training and competency has to be performed and then actually documented before you even let them go in. So it used to be like you would just throw them into the fire and just let them start learning on the job. But that's really not appropriate. It needs to sort of take that approach that I mentioned earlier of read it, shadow it, try it, do it.
What should pharmacy technicians and pharmacy professionals in general be on the lookout for in regards to these changes?
You know, look out for some of the changes in facilities, cleaning, garbing, drug components that are used. You know, there's a little bit more nuances that need to be looked at there. And I would say that there's a little bit of each section that was touched, but the main thing is the beyond use date limits. And also that water activity concept that was introduced in 795. So as to when we're gonna hear about the proposed, if it's been accepted, I think pharmacy techs and pharmacists, they should be encouraged to submit their comments. And USP has a very, at least they're trying to be very clear on how to do this. You can go to usp.org or just Google it. That's what I've just did an internet search, and you can find exactly where to submit your comments. Do so before January 31st, because that's the cutoff. Then the committee is going to go and review every single comment submitted. They're going to take those comments into account. It could then lead to other amendments or changes in this proposal. So do your part and you know, tell them what you think or what you see that could be an issue for your own operation. And as far as when it could be ready, I don't really know. It could be as early as next summer or winter. So, you know, just sort of keep a lookout and we'll see if it gets approved.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Tech Talk. Tune in for the next episode next month, where we will be joined by another key opinion leader in the pharmacy technician space. Thank you.